years. Adding additional channels will be even more important as your growth takes off. One reason is that you will almost inevitably reach a natural ceiling with any given channel, after which you just won't be able to squeeze enough new customers from it to make it worthwhile. After all, you can only show so many ads to the same audience on Facebook before they tune you out, sending your click-through rates through the floor and your costs soaring. And there are only so many times you can hit up your loyalty card members with promotions before they start relegating your emails to their spam folders. When you reach these maximum capacities, you need to layer on additional channels to achieve additional growth. As we've said, growth teams should periodically shift their focus to the next stage of the customer funnel, moving on from acquisition to activation and then on to retention. And we'll move on shortly ourselves to activation in the next chapter. But first, it's important to take a good look at the subject of viral user acquisition, which has become closely associated with the growth hacking process. Sometimes, growth hacking has even been described mistakenly as being all about creating viral loops for bringing in users, meaning mechanisms such as referral programs. Such viral mechanisms can be remarkably powerful, as we saw with Dropbox. But there are a number of misunderstandings about both how to create them and the kind of growth to expect from them. So before we move to the next step and talk about how to activate this new customer base you are building, we want to share the truth versus the hype and show you what the various kinds of viral loops look like and how to experiment with making them best work for you. Designing customer loops. The rapid success of growth hacks that involve viral loops, like the Hotmail email signature line that encouraged recipients of emails to sign up, and the Dropbox incentive program that offered free storage space in exchange for referrals, might suggest that creating such powerful incentives for users to share your product with their personal networks is a good deal easier to do than it usually is. One of the myths about a viral loop is that you can set it and forget it, and let the word of mouth do all of your acquisition work for you. But the reality is much less idyllic. It's important to realize that not all viral loops are created equal. Creating effective loops is simply much easier for some products than others. At the easy end is a product like Venmo, a mobile payments app owned by PayPal. A product that is delivering money to people clearly has the edge. Who's not going to sign up in order to receive the cash waiting for them? For most other products, though, incentivizing users to send out and accept invites is a good deal trickier. And most often, triggering anything even approaching truly viral growth requires a great deal of initial experimentation and then lots of continuous optimization. Unfortunately, there is no magic formula, but there are methods for finding strategies that work for you. Here, it's important to remember what we learned in Chapter 2 about building a must-have product. If your product isn't delivering value, if it doesn't deliver the aha moment, then no viral loop strategy is going to help you. Remember earlier, we described the news site Upworthy skill for generating virality through brilliantly catchy headlines. A big part of their success comes from their recognition that the article's content is equally important to creating viral attention. "We don't mind tricking people into seeing content they'll love," says founder Eli Pariser. "If they don't love it, they're not going to share it. Virality is a balance of how good the packaging is and how good the content is." The takeaway is that while finding the right words to appeal to people is vital, offering true value is a necessary ingredient for achieving viral growth. Another subject of much misunderstanding when it comes to viral growth is the very meaning of the term itself. For one thing, it's important to distinguish between the types of virality, one being the traditional word-of-mouth variety, and the other being a feature built into a product that provides a mechanism for users to hook in more users, which is often referred to as instrumented virality. A product can absolutely grow through both types. And as remarked earlier, even some products that seem to have grown primarily through instrumented virality, Facebook being a leading case in point, in fact grew largely through word of mouth. As Chamath Palihapitiya at Facebook reminds us, he told the growth team not to even think about instrumenting virality at first, and to focus instead on building a great product. Which brings up a key point. When you do focus on instrumenting virality, it's important that you follow the same basic principle as for building your product. You've got to make the experience of sharing the product with others must-have, or at least as user-friendly and delightful as possible. Hotmail's email signature link, for example, was the epitome of a good experience. One click and a very brief sign-up process, and you've got free email. Similarly, Sean worked intensively with the Dropbox team on their referral program to make the steps fun and easy, from the welcoming design of the program to the ease of sending and accepting invites. All in all, the design of the program made it not only easy to invite friends, but even a joy. As a result, in both cases, the viral loops were so effective that people not only took part, they felt good about the experience and raved about it to whoever would listen. Another common misunderstanding about viral growth stems from the definition of a viral product as it's generally understood in the growth hacking community, which is that to be truly viral, the product must have a viral coefficient, or K factor, of greater than 1. This means that each new user who signs up brings in one or more new people to the product. Yet achieving this degree of virality is extremely rare, and when achieved, it's often only for very brief periods of time. To appreciate how unrealistic it is as a goal, let's just briefly look at how the viral coefficient is calculated. Don't worry, it's determined by a very simple equation. Viral coefficient K equals invites sent out by customers times the percentage of those invited who accept the invite. Let's say you have 25,000 users and you launch a referral program, and 25% of your users go ahead and take you up on the offer. The average number of people they send invites to is 5, and on average, 10% of people invited go ahead and accept the invite. That would mean you bring in 3,125 new users, which is 50% growth with just one pass through the viral loop. Such a response to any marketing effort would constitute a huge success. And yet the viral coefficient of this referral program would be 5 times 10%, equaling 0.5. A far cry from the 1.0 definition of true virality. But enough with the inside baseball about viral growth definitions. The takeaway isn't that growth teams shouldn't try to kickstart viral growth. Rather, they need to be more practical in their assessment of viral potential. We encourage teams to experiment with creating viral engagement loops, and in fact, to work on creating a number of them for any given product. But in doing so, teams should set and communicate realistic expectations, both within the team and with management. Rather than worry about your viral coefficient, which we've shown is fleeting and also fails to account for key factors that determine viral growth, you can come up with a helpful assessment of the degree of virality you're much more likely to be able to achieve by using a very simple formula devised by Sean Parker, co-founder of Napster and former president of Facebook. He taught early employees at the social network that the virality of any product is controlled by three factors: payload, conversion rate, and frequency, which can be expressed by the simple rule, virality equals payload times conversion rate times frequency. Payload is the number of people to whom each user will likely send the promotion, or link, widget, etc., at a time. So for example, in Hotmail's case, most users sent emails to just one recipient, with a much smaller number sending emails to small groups, and only very few personal emails going to a long list. So the payload for Hotmail's email signature signup link was low. The second factor is the conversion rate of the invite, which for Hotmail was very high, because at that time, free email was unheard of and very appealing. The final factor is the frequency with which people will be exposed to the invites, i.e., how often emails will be sent. In Hotmail's case, this was again high, because most people email some group of friends, family, and people they're doing work with quite often. So even with low payload, the high conversion rate and frequency made Hotmail's link extremely viral. Your goal in creating a viral loop is to optimize the three variables to create growth. As you begin to consider what sort of viral loop to experiment with, you've got to make a couple of key decisions. First, you need to choose how invites will be delivered. In the best viral loops, the delivery is a natural result of using the product, as was the case for Hotmail, where users didn't have to do anything in addition to sending their emails. The invitation to join was embedded in the email itself, so the referrals were completely passive. Asking so little of your users is not always possible, though. You'll often need to offer users an incentive. The best way to do this is to create a double-sided incentive. That is, one that offers something to both the sender and the recipient. If you have a high payload, you may not need as compelling an incentive in order to get good results, because even a fairly small percentage of responses will add up nicely. But if your payload is low, you're likely going to need a more compelling incentive for both parties to drive up your conversion rate and frequency. A common trap companies fall into when trying to optimize a loop is to engineer ways to ratchet up the number of people being sent referrals to the point that users and those they've made referrals to are annoyed. Anyone who has accidentally sent an invite to download an app to their phone's entire contact list can appreciate how enraging this can be. User experience experts call tricks to get users to take an action they normally would not take dark patterns. And while some of these dark patterns may work in the short term, the backlash from users is a long-term drag on growth. The negative press and bad feelings these kinds of tricks stir up can even be enough to torpedo the best products. We've seen it happen. Here are a number of best practices for experimenting with creating loops that will help you avoid such pitfalls. Consider the potential to tap network effects. The best loops are ones in which users are motivated to help sign up more users because doing so will improve their own experience of the product, such as with Facebook or LinkedIn. Network effect products have a great natural advantage with viral growth for this reason. They get better the more people are using them, so people are inclined to urge others to come on board. Social networks and messaging apps are obvious examples, as are big marketplaces that connect buyers directly with sellers, like eBay and Etsy, because more people using the site quite simply means more potential customers for me as a seller and selection for me as a buyer. Some products simply don't have this characteristic, such as the grocery chain's mobile app. For example, if you refer your next-door neighbor to the app, that will have no impact on your own user experience. But many companies have some degree of network effect potential that they can and should tap, even if it's not obvious on the surface. For example, with Dropbox, the more files I have stored, the more likely I will invite people to join Dropbox to collaborate on them. While the more people I know who use Dropbox, the easier file sharing is going to be. That's why doing the legwork to learn about how your customers use your product and where potential loops can be created and optimized is essential for tapping into viral growth driven through network effects. Eventbrite is a company that has created a powerful viral loop by tapping its network effect potential. The company is a hub for event promotion that makes money from taking a cut of ticket sales made through the site, and quite cleverly built in a social-driven loop by encouraging ticket buyers to share with their friends that they're going to an event. This clearly is a way to bring in more users and to drive more ticket sales, but it also offers an upside for ticket buyers, because having more friends attend an event you're going to usually, depending on the friends, enhances the experience. This loop has also helped Eventbrite attract more event organizers, because it has been able to leverage these sharing loops to help organizers sell more tickets. In fact, Eventbrite found that each new share of an event generated $3.23 in incremental revenue for event organizers. Create an incentive that's in synergy with your product's core value. If there's no inherent incentive to share built into the user experience, you may have to create that incentive, generally by offering a reward of some kind. But it's critical that whatever reward users receive for making the referral be relevant to the core value of the product. If the grocery store app offered a free flower vase for making at least 3 referrals, for example, while some shoppers might find the incentive appealing, for many it would seem odd, an outlier to what they're expecting from a grocery store. But if the grocery chain were launching florist services, clearly that offer would be right in alignment with the product being promoted. We talked earlier about language market fit and product channel fit. Think of this as product incentive fit. This was the genius of the Dropbox referral program. The product was about both storing files and easily sharing them with others. So not only was getting more people using the Dropbox service entirely in keeping with users' interests, getting more storage space for free was an incentive also totally in line with the core value of the product. A good rule of thumb is, whether you are selling a service or a physical product or some kind of information or content, the value of your incentive should be as closely aligned to that as possible. Cash offers can work also, but for the best effect, it's important that they're also related to the core value of the product. Airbnb offers a $25 incentive for both inviters and invitees to use toward a future stay booked through Airbnb. Here, using messaging tied to the product or brand matters. In Airbnb's case, they use language suggesting that customers share the great experience of living like a local that Airbnb delivers, rather than just blatantly offering the cash. Similarly, for our grocery app team, offering a referral program where each shopper using the app gets a $10 discount on their next grocery order makes good sense, as it acts as a one-time discount on their purchase. The downside of offering cash, even in the form of discounts, is that it's very easy to calculate its value in relation to what you are asked to do to receive it. And this can make it hard to motivate people to act without larger sums to stir action. Contrast offering $10 to someone versus 250 free megabytes of space on Dropbox. How much is that space worth? It's hard to set a value on it as a user. It feels highly valuable, but for Dropbox, the incremental cost is exceptionally low. Make the invite to share an integrated part of the user's experience, not an add-on. There's a fine line to walk when it comes to inviting users to share with others. You don't want the prompt to be obtrusive, which can be irritating and perceived as too pushy, but you do want your users to see it. The best way to toe this line is to integrate the prompt as seamlessly as possible with the user experience. Too many companies add referral programs into their products as afterthoughts. Another reason why the product managers, designers, and engineers should be involved in growth team efforts, so they can take these considerations into account when building the initial product, and include them on web pages or screens that are rarely visited. Unfortunately, this low visibility all but guarantees that there is never enough critical mass to kickstart the viral loop. Far better to integrate the prompt into the more highly trafficked areas, like the new user experience, or on the home screen. At ScoreBig, a live event ticketing platform I worked for, the team saw a massive spike in friend invites sent out when they integrated the referral program into the new user experience, whereas before it had only been accessible from a small link tucked into the corner at the top of the website homepage. If you start to pay attention to this on the websites and apps you visit, you'll quickly notice which do and don't do this effectively. LinkedIn prompts you as soon as you join to see who you are connected with and to import your email contacts to build your network. Uber prominently promotes an incentive to invite your friends right on the screen that details the status of the ride you're currently taking. Under close scrutiny, you'll find that most companies that have generated some word-of-mouth growth have gone through great pains to make their instrumented viral loops visible within plain sight, while at the same time appealing and intuitive to their customers. Make sure the invitees are given a good experience. Another common mistake is neglecting to optimize the experience that invitees receive when they respond to an invite. For example, abruptly hitting them with a request to create an account on the service before they even know what the site is about and why they should bother joining. Contrast this to the masterfully appealing experience Airbnb has created for new invitees. First, the invite includes the name and a picture of the person who invited you, along with a personalized message about the incentive, which at the time of this recording was, "Your friend Morgan gave you $25 off your first trip on Airbnb, the best way to travel. Be sure to say thanks." The call to action is also prominent and simple, a large box labeled "Claim Your Credit." The benefits are twofold here. Not only will invitees be more inclined to respond, they'll also be more receptive to sending referrals themselves because they now know they aren't spamming their friends with a shoddy or overly pushy invite. Experiment, experiment, experiment. Remember, most instant successes have required extensive experimentation, and successful viral loops are no different. The brilliant strategies you've read about in this chapter didn't emerge out of thin air, but rather through a great deal of testing and optimization, which has involved plenty of surprises for growth teams along the way. At Dropbox, Sean and the team were surprised to find, for example, that if invites to share a file also promoted the value proposition of online storage space, it actually hurt the conversion rate. When the page that greeted invitees instead emphasized how the service facilitated collaboration and file sharing, however, the conversion rate spiked up. Why? Those invitees hadn't yet experienced the desire to get online storage space. But the beauty of being able to share files so easily with the people who had referred them, and anyone else, of course, was immediately appealing. In hindsight, it makes sense. But chances are the growth team would have never uncovered this insight had they not experimented. LinkedIn was equally surprised to discover that its invite program was more effective if inviters were prompted to send more invites than the original prompt had suggested, but not too many. At first, the prompt suggested that users invite two other people. But rather than just leave it at that, the team experimented with asking users to send a few more invitations. And they did. But when they got up to six invites, the response started to drop off. The growth team ultimately discovered that the optimal number of invites to recommend users to make was 4. The point is, many of the best hacks are unanticipated discoveries. The methods you heard about in this chapter are designed to help you find them strategically, efficiently, and at low cost. Okay, having explored how to bring in loads of new users, let's now take a close look at how to make sure they become active once you've hooked them. Chapter 6. Hacking Activation. Now that you've worked so hard to attract all these potential customers, how do you engage them in actually using your product? Or in growth hacking parlance, to get them activated? Unfortunately, this is something many companies get wrong. In fact, 98% of traffic to websites does not lead to activation. And most mobile apps lose up to 80% of their users within 3 days. Improving activation is at its core about increasing the rate at which you get new users to your aha moment. The more visitors who experience what makes your product a must-have, the more of them will stick with you. The growth hacking process provides a rigorous set of steps for probing into the impediments to the aha experience, and then experimenting with hacks for improving activation. There is no one formula for improving activation. Your efforts must be tailored specifically to your product, and your ideas for experimentation should be inspired by analysis of your specific data. Luckily, the growth hacking process offers the playbook to help get you there. In this chapter, we will first introduce the 3 essential steps every growth team must take in order to identify the highest impact activation experiments to run. Then we will introduce a set of best practices for increasing activation that have been implemented to great effect by fast growth companies. A closing section takes a special look at one of the most effective, but also most often abused tactics, the use of triggers, which are prompts to users that urge them to re-engage with a product. We'll introduce the ins and outs of the sticky business of getting triggers right. Mapping the route to the aha moment. The first step in hacking activation is to identify each point in your customer's journey toward the aha moment. We are assuming that you have already determined, in the process of making the product must-have, what constitutes this magical moment. To see how to create your map of points along the way, let's use the case of the grocery app. As you might recall from Chapter 3, the team has determined that the aha experience comes when shoppers realize they can use the app to easily and quickly order their groceries on the fly, in those in-between moments when they've got a bit of spare time, or as they randomly think of or remember an item they need as they are running around and going about their daily lives. The next thing the team needs to do is list all of the steps that new users must take in order to have this experience. They need to download the app, find items they want, add them to their carts, create an account by adding in their name, credit card, and delivery information, then make the purchase itself. And to truly make the experience must-have, they've got to receive their complete order as expected at home. Just listening to these steps, you can think of many ways in which users might lose interest or become frustrated and exit the app rather than making a purchase. The app might be annoyingly slow. Users might find searching for items cumbersome. Creating an account might be overly complicated. But in growth hacking, it's crucial that you never assume why users are behaving as they are. Rather, you've always got to study hard data about their behavior and then query them on the basis of observations you've made in order to focus your experimentation efforts most efficiently on changes that will have the greatest potential impact. Even if you think you understand what the barriers to activation are, the true story can be quite surprising. Once you've identified the steps that lead up to the aha moment, the next step toward homing in on stumbling blocks for customers and figuring out what's causing them to flee is to calculate the conversion rates for each of the steps on the way to the aha moment. Or, in other words, the percentage of all visitors who are taking each of those steps along the path to success. Creating a funnel report of conversions and drop-offs. One of the best ways to measure conversion rates is through a funnel report, a tool that displays the rates at which people who come to your product are moving on to each of the key steps in the customer journey, and, by the same token, where they're dropping off. Here's a very basic hypothetical one created by Kissmetrics, which describes a quite common drop-off between first visit and sign-up. Imagine a simple funnel report showing the number of people who visited the site, 328,228, the number who signed up, 71,159, the number who activated, 9,748, and the number billed, 7,184. Of course, the steps for which you calculate percentages will be specific to your product. For this hypothetical product, they were initial visit, sign up, activation, and billing. For another company, let's say Uber, the funnel report might display the rate at which people are downloading the app, then the opening of the app, then the number who proceed to create a new account, the rate at which people book a ride, and the rate at which they rate their driver, and so on. For other businesses, steps might include, for example, inviting friends, downloading a white paper, watching a video, or visiting a retail store. The point is that whatever your product is, you should be tracking all essential steps of the customer journey to that moment of activation. In addition to tracking the conversion rate of key action steps, the report should track the visitors according to the route or channels by which they've come to the product, whether from Google search or AdWords, from Facebook or Twitter, from online banner ads, from customer referrals, etc. Surprising differences in activation rate by channel can lead to high-impact discoveries that may cause you to go back and re-experiment with some of the acquisition channels you isolated following the steps in the last chapter. Once this data is available, you will look for differences between active customers, those who activated but then went cold, and those who never activated or have bounced. In essence, this report gives you a detailed overview of what the sticking points are for customers coming through each of your channels, which can be used to improve the rate at which you turn new customers into active ones. Let's see how the grocery app team proceeds at this stage in the process. The data analyst on the growth team will create a funnel report that calculates the rates for downloading and opening the app, the rates at which people are searching for items to buy, the rate at which people are adding items to the shopping cart, and finally, creating an account and purchasing. In addition, they'll also track key additional steps, such as the rates at which people activate on any special offers or promotions, like the $10 off a first purchase offer we described them experimenting with earlier. Let's say that the team had gone ahead with creating the shopping list feature, which, as we noted earlier, was an experiment they put into their schedule for development, and that's been available for a couple of months now. They are going to also want to calculate the rate at which people are adding items to their lists, and also the rate at which they are then going ahead and purchasing the list of items. Often, these activation funnel reports can be very straightforward, providing that your team has taken the steps outlined in Chapter 3 to properly define metrics and establish ways to track them. Many analytics packages, such as Kissmetrics, Mixpanel, Google Analytics, and Adobe Omniture Site Catalyst, offer the ability to create these funnels based on specific events and provide a variety of creative and useful funnel visualization and tracking tools. Other times, things can get a bit more complicated, especially if your activation funnel may need to be created by combining multiple sources of data. But a data expert will be able to identify the proper data sources to query and build the funnel report, even if data lives in additional places. Yet another reason why every growth team needs a data analyst. In sitting down to look at the data, the team now makes a set of intriguing observations. They learn that a large number of app users are adding items to their shopping carts and then leaving before they add their credit card information. They also see that quite a number of users aren't searching for many items, and also that the shoppers who are the most active in the first week after downloading the app browsed quite a few items on their first visit. Finally, they observe that a large percentage of visitors who use the shopping list feature to add items to it proceed to purchase them, and that many of those purchasers go on to become repeat purchasers. Armed with this data, it is clear that one major stumbling block is the checkout experience. So the team will want to consider experiments with making it easier to check out, perhaps by trying a new payment form design that's easier or quicker to complete. Since search volume is low among new users, they should also consider experiments aimed at encouraging first visitors to browse more items, perhaps by making it easier to search for items from the app home screen, or by making searching more enticing by highlighting special offers for various products, or by prominently recommending sections of the app, say a screen for most popular products, to explore. So they've got lots of options to choose from. But before they start experimenting, there is one more step in data discovery. They must get out into the wild and conduct some surveys and interviews to probe into the reasons for the user behavior the data has revealed. This will greatly help them to narrow their focus and come up with the highest potential hacks to try. The growth team at Qualaroo, the online survey company Sean founded, followed the same process for coming up with ideas for possible hacks to boost activation. By deeply analyzing our user data, looking for differences in the experiences of people who used Qualaroo for free and then purchased versus those who tried the product but ultimately didn't buy, we learned that most people who ultimately purchased had run trial surveys that elicited at least 50 responses. Knowing that the aha moment for the product was getting actionable user feedback from surveys, we determined that 50 survey responses was the tipping point, after which the value of surveys became clear. So to get more users to experience the aha moment, we tried many experiments aimed at increasing the likelihood that new trial users would get at least 50 responses on a survey. These included a number of efforts to improve customer education about which surveys to run, through new email copy we wrote, and also through tutorial videos about the types of surveys to run in order to get information about specific sorts of issues and suggestions about where to run them. We also changed the set of recommended surveys shown to new users to ones that would be run in broader uses and attract greater response rates, such as Net Promoter Score surveys. Finally, Sean tasked the customer success team with doing proactive outreach to visitors in order to give them tips about deploying surveys. All of these experiments combined led to a dramatic increase in customer activation rate, even as we tripled the cost of the product. Survey do's and don'ts. You've probably had the experience of customer survey pop-ups on an app or website you were using, just as you were in the middle of browsing or on your way to buying something. These can be very effective discovery tools for growth hackers, but they can also be quite annoying to users. To get the most useful responses, while at the same time assuring a survey is not a turnoff to customers, it should be very brief and should be delivered to users under two main conditions. One, when their activity indicates confusion, such as lingering on one page for too long, or leaving the screen or page on the app or site. Or two, right after they've gone ahead and taken the step that many others aren't taking, such as creating an account or making a purchase. Both can also yield valuable insights about why that customer decided to take the next step or not. We advise asking one or two questions at maximum, which either can be open-ended or can offer a set of answers to select from. We have a preference for open-ended questions because they don't shoehorn people into your preconceived notions of what the problems users are encountering are. Letting them respond with whatever they feel like sharing allows them to surprise you. For example, maybe the grocery app team thought the obvious reason why shoppers weren't checking out might be that the payment form was too complex. But survey feedback may reveal that a bigger factor was that shoppers weren't sure if they were going to be charged for delivery or not, or perhaps that they forgot the code to enter to get their first-time shopper discount. This is the type of qualitative information that can't be gleaned from hard data alone, which is why surveying customers is such an important piece of the process. To get this information, if you have these customers' contact information, you can simply email or call them to ask them these questions voice to voice. For those who've browsed and bounced without giving you any contact info, a survey can be programmed to pop up right as the browsing patterns indicate that they're about to leave a page or screen. Companies like Bounce Exchange, Qualaroo, Qualtrics, and others offer tools that can do this. You'd be surprised by how many people will stop and answer your questions before they leave. And keeping it as short as possible will only improve the rate of response. In this case, you want to ask, what has stopped them from moving forward? With questions such as, is there anything preventing you from signing up at this point? What concerns are keeping you from completing your order? If you did not make a purchase today, can you tell us why not? What information would you need to feel comfortable signing up today? Perhaps somewhat counterintuitively, some of the best information you will get about reasons people are abandoning your product at any given step will come from people who didn't give up. For example, to probe into why so many people visiting the grocery app aren't completing their purchases, the team should survey people who just completed a purchase. After all, these shoppers will also have encountered whatever obstacles are stopping other shoppers up, and may have insight on why they chose to continue along anyway, while others did not. So the team might display a brief survey on the order confirmation screen that asks shoppers, what's the one thing that nearly stopped you from completing your order? We found this one thing question elicits a high number of responses and ones that are very eye-opening. Of course, the questions you ask will depend upon the drop-off point you're asking about. Others might be, what were you hoping to find on this page? Does this page contain the information you were looking for? What did you come to our site or app to do today? What convinced you to complete your purchase today? On this screen, it seems like I should be able to. Was there anything about the checkout process we should improve? Once the grocery team has done all this, they now have both the data and the color commentary from customers they need to evaluate a first set of ideas for experiments. Let's say they decide to prioritize two experiments to start. Since surveys revealed that customers often left before making a purchase because they couldn't remember their discount code, the team could try automatically adding the visitor's first-time discount code on the checkout page. Not only would this change be likely to improve results, it would also be significantly faster and less expensive than a complete redesign of the app's shopping cart. Additionally, the data showing that so many of those who added items to the new shopping list proceeded to purchase them may lead them to experiment with promoting the shopping list feature more prominently on the app home screen after installation. And with that, they're off and running. but they'll likely have to try many experiments for each of these ideas, and others as well, in order to optimize activation. Always remember that there are no silver bullets in growth hacking, and that even what seem like slam dunk ideas can fail. Be persistent and you'll get the payoff. To illustrate how surprising the discoveries you can make through this process will often be, let's take a close look at the set of experiments that the growth team at HubSpot ran to try to stoke adoption for its new Sidekick product, a tool that allows salespeople to track the effectiveness of their email outreach. At the time, Sidekick was facing a problem common to newly launched products. They saw strong organic adoption via word of mouth, but activation was sluggish. To get to the bottom of the flagging activation rates, the Sidekick team first dug into the data to find the differences between users who tried the product and stuck with it and those who installed Sidekick and disappeared. They began by segmenting their users into buckets of people with similar attributes, starting with the general set of common differences, including the different traffic sources they were coming from, such as Google and Facebook. Then they went deeper, analyzing new users by job role, the type of email that they sent, whether they used Sidekick for sales prospecting or public relations outreach or other uses, and the email service they used, such as Gmail or Outlook. One discovery they made was that users who signed up using their work email address as opposed to their personal email account had a higher activation rate. So their first step was to experiment with getting people to use their work emails instead of their personal email addresses. At Qualaroo, we found similar results with non-work email addresses. So we used language on the sign-up form instructing users to use their work email addresses and would not let people sign up when they entered in an email ending in @gmail.com, @hotmail.com, and so on. Another discovery they made was that most people who didn't go on to become active users never sent more than a single email after installing the application. To probe into why, the team started to collect feedback from users who stopped using the product. And when they did, they were rather shocked to discover that people were saying that they jumped ship because they didn't understand how to use it. The team had been certain that the app was a breeze to understand and use. In fact, once installed, Sidekick simply worked in the background. But the data told another story. So they concluded that they should run experiments with ways of educating visitors on how to use the email tracking add-on. The team tried adding various types of explanation on the landing page visitors arrived at once they had installed the app, and experimented with videos that demonstrated how to use the product, and also tried showing a sample of the kind of report users receive about the activities seen on their sent emails. But to their surprise, every one of those tests failed to improve adoption. The team ultimately ran 11 separate experiments, and still, nothing took. At this point, the bewildered growth team decided they needed to step back and take another dive into the data. Maybe more education wasn't the issue, but perhaps instead the key was to get people to the aha moment faster. What if, rather than sending people to the app's landing page after installation, they simply showed them a message that told them that the application had installed successfully and that they were ready to start sending email? Finally, this experiment worked. That message seemed to be a much-needed trigger to get people to go ahead and actually use the app. Then, the beauty of its utility would quickly hit them. So the growth team added the messaging, and the activation rate dramatically improved. But the team didn't stop there. They went on to run another 68 experiments. Some worked, some didn't, and many yielded more surprises. But they all produced insights that led to significant increases in activation, a perfect model of doing growth hacking right. The key takeaway here is that you cannot know ahead of time which experiments are going to be most effective. The best you can do is stay nimble and data-driven, continuously tailoring experiments according to the discoveries you make, and then being ready to quickly adjust and try other approaches if experiments aren't working as hypothesized. While there is most definitely a core set of best practices for improving activation, which we will now introduce, you must consider these as less of a playbook to follow and more as a set of examples and sources of ideas as you consider experiments to try. Remember that every product is different, and you won't get far by simply focusing on problems that are common but that aren't at the crux of what is getting in the way of activation for your particular customers. The bottom line is, there are no shortcuts. But if you follow the three steps we have outlined above, you will rapidly discover ideas and insights that will produce dramatic gains in activation for your product. To recap, those steps are: map all of the steps that get users to the aha moment. Create a funnel report that profiles the conversion rates for each of the steps and segments users by the channel through which they arrive. And conduct surveys and interviews, both of users who progress through each step where you're seeing high drop-offs and those who left at that point, to understand the causes of drop-off. You can then use this information to create new, highly targeted, and high-impact ideas to experiment with to improve your results. Now, let's look at the most common obstacles to activation and how to design experiments for hacks to avoid them. Eradicating friction. In user experience design, friction is the term used to refer to any annoying hindrances that prevent someone from accomplishing the action they're trying to complete, such as ads that pop up in the middle of an article you're reading, or overly distorted letters in a CAPTCHA that force you to make repeated attempts at entering them successfully before submitting a form. For a physical product, such as a coffee maker, it might be an annoyingly complicated procedure for setting an automatic brew time. The incredible irritation of friction is well understood. Who hasn't experienced it? But what's tricky is that while we certainly notice the friction in the products we use, we often don't recognize sources of friction in the ones we've been involved in creating or marketing. Perhaps this is because we know how they work so intimately that our brains just can't see the impediments. Designers who watch people stumble in trying to use products they've worked on are often shocked to see how much difficulty people are having. A great deal of attention has been focused on the need to remove friction from the user experience of online products. And yet, it's everywhere. From the e-commerce checkout forms that require you to create an account before making your purchase, to pop-ups that ask you to rate or review an app before you've even had the chance to experience using it, to zip code fields that don't recognize alphanumeric Canadian postal codes. With every irritating hoop a new user has to jump through, she's thinking to herself, is it worth it? And if the value of your product isn't clear and compelling enough, even the slightest irritation can send people away, often for good. Sean devised a simple formula to help keep the importance of continuously looking to reduce friction top of mind. Desire minus friction equals conversion rate. As the formula implies, the more visitors desire your product, the more friction they will generally be willing to work their way through. This is why early adopters are such a godsend for new or nascent products. They're often willing to use and even pay for your product even when it has some serious glitches. I have an enviable Gmail email address because during Gmail's early beta period, I was willing to go to eBay and bid on a coveted invite to the service just so I could get the Gmail address I wanted. Customers with that level of desire, it might also be considered a form of insanity, are going to be willing to tolerate the inconvenience of bugs and annoyances, but the rest won't. In order to improve activation, you can either increase your customer's desire or reduce the friction they experience, and making a product more desirable is generally a good deal harder than discovering and eliminating sources of friction. Eliminating friction, in other words, is the lower-hanging fruit, which is why many of the most successful growth teams have dedicated a great deal of effort to it. Think of your funnel conversion report as your roadmap to the sources of friction in your customer journey. Sometimes, just scrutinizing big drop-off points alone will reveal the impediments to begin experimenting with removing or redesigning. Slow download times and glitchy shopping carts are common examples. But perhaps the most problematic friction point is often right at the beginning of the customer journey, in the new user experience, or NUX. Optimizing the new user experience. The first rule of designing and optimizing your NUX is to treat it as a unique, one-time encounter with your product. As such, you should think of it as a product of its own. This means that you will need to craft a special experience for it, one that entices users to engage with the product and appreciate what it has to offer. A great benefit of creating these separate experiences, which means a separate series of pages or screens, either within the product, if it is a web product, or on the company or brand site, if it is not, is that it makes experimenting with the NUX easier for a growth team, because they don't have to worry about their tests interfering with the experience of the current users. The second rule is that the first landing page of the NUX must accomplish three fundamental things. Communicate relevance, show the value of the product, and provide a clear call to action. Brian Eisenberg, who is widely considered the godfather of conversion optimization, refers to these three factors as the conversion trinity. Relevance stands for how well the page matches the intent and desire of the visitor. Is this what they came for? Showing value is immediately answering the visitor's question, "What's in it for me?" clearly and concisely. Lastly, the call to action provides a compelling next step for visitors to take. Doing all of these things may seem intuitive, but unfortunately, most landing pages are lacking in one or another, if not all of these must-haves. Optimizing these pages generally requires running many experiments with the language. Again, not just the taglines and call to action, but the text that accompanies images and that appears on subsections or farther reaches of the page. As much as the messaging here matters, so do the aesthetics. So you'll want to also experiment with size, positioning, and ratios of both the text and imagery. Experimenting with simplifying the page, stripping out text and/or images, is also important, as is sometimes adding in more explanatory text and/or imagery. In short, all of the elements of the NUX should be scrutinized for problems. But there are two key tactics that have recently proven powerful in removing friction across a wide range of businesses and products. Single sign-on. Simplifying the sign-up process is one of the key areas to experiment with, as often, reducing the amount of information people must provide up front can result in a big improvement in how many choose to sign up. This has been made dead simple now that Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Google, and others have made simple login applications available to web and mobile developers that enable their users to sign on with their existing accounts, a feature called single sign-on, or also social sign-on. This technology can be a game changer when it comes to reducing friction in the sign-on process. Offering a single click to create a new account can dramatically improve conversion rates, particularly on mobile devices, where data entry can be especially challenging. While single sign-on is more commonly used by companies offering consumer products, it can also work for B2B companies as well. As the growth team at Kissmetrics